Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Is financial fair play world football's attempt at financial self-regulation creating an unfair playing field? How are FFP rules affecting the recruitment policy at clubs across Europe? And what are the loopholes being jumped through to gain a competitive advantage during the current transfer window? The vast majority of the spending comes, and this is not going to be a surprise, from the Premier League. I'm Mark Chapman. This is the Athletic Football Podcast.
We've got some big breaking transfer news right now. Chelsea just announced that they have completed the signing of Mykhailo Mudryk. The Ukrainian has signed for what we believe to be a fee that could rise up to £88.5 million. Money!
Right now, Arsenal have signed Leandro Trossard, a deal worth £27 million. Money,
it's a gas. We do have breaking news. It's the story we've been talking about at the top of the show. And wow. West Ham, we are told, have now completed the transfer of Aston Villa striker Danny Ings. We are told the fee is £15 million for Danny Ings.
Netherlands' Cody Hakpo will join Liverpool in the new year.
A deal of more than £35 million has been agreed with PSV Eindhoven. Money,
it's a hit. Right, so financial fair play. That's what we're going to take. Don't hit the pause button or the stop button, right? Where Matt Slater and Dan Sheldon from The Athletic are here. Both have written plenty on FFP. Club ownership and transfers. We're going to make this sing, aren't we, Dan?
We're going to try to. Matt will do a better job than I will.
Matt, you're going to make this sing?
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm not singing.
Look, if you go into the Athletic website, type FFP in the search tab, there are a huge range of articles where FFP is either the main theme or at least plays a part in the story. So stories around ownership, recruitment, direction at clubs, transfers, player contracts. You could pick out Leicester, Juve, Fulham, Barcelona, Paris Saint-Germain. There probably isn't a club that this doesn't affect. And you can go down, if you're looking just within England, Matt, you can go down the leagues for this.
Yeah, you certainly can. So I would argue that financial fair play hasn't been a particularly big issue for the big clubs in the Premier League for a while. Broadly speaking, financial fair play is about 10 years old, maybe a bit longer than that. And there were sort of kind of two strands to it. UEFA got very alarmed at the sort of late noughties about the number of clubs that owed their tax authorities huge amounts of money. And there were, you know, various clubs sort of teetering on the brink all over the continent, to be honest. And it was this sort of huge debt to the public authorities. It was frankly embarrassing. So UEFA under Michel Platini started to sort of think about salary caps, soft salary caps, because salary caps, we often talk about, you know, comparisons with North American sport, are very controversial here because of the European Union and competition and just totally different tradition. And, you know, we're just starting from different places. So soft salary cap. So a way of sort of encouraging teams to spend within their means and how you do that. So you sort of tie spending, your ability to go out and buy players and pay them whatever you want to pay them, to your revenue. Right. Pretty simple, right? Spend what you've got coming in and hopefully it all adds up and evens out and we've got sustainable businesses. So that was sort of European FFP, and their key concept was this break-even rule. PSG, Man City, we've been around the houses. It's been sort of 10 years of these cases. Do you break even, yes or no? And is the amount of money you're bringing in legitimate? Are you being honest about the amounts you're spending? And then with this sort of little bit of kind of a safety net where you have some allowable losses, and that was phased in. So we're going to let teams lose a little bit of money as long as it's backed up by equity, i.e. the owners are good for it and putting it in. And you know, and that's broadly speaking worked. Oh God, that's another massive debate about how it's worked and whether it's worked in the right way. But it's of course have worked. Now the Premier League rules, broadly similar. Again, that kind of break-even concept. The impetus there was really the embarrassment of Portsmouth. You know, a Premier League club should never go into administration. Portsmouth did. It went, you know, it went bust, and that was deeply embarrassing to the world's most successful blah 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 league. So they sort of brought in FFP rules of their own. As I said, they're kind of related to the UEFA ones with a much bigger safety net. So really, the Premier League rules have come in, and no other club has got anywhere near breaking that, and it hasn't really been an issue. It's only really been an issue in the European context because that allowable loss was so much tighter. But again, no Premier League clubs have ever really got close to it. We've had some big cases. Man City obviously is the most famous one, but that was really more about the source of their revenue as opposed to, are you close to this number, yes or no? It was about the source of the revenue. So we've had that. They're all changing. I can't stick all that into this answer. But that's where we've been. And I suppose the other thing I probably should add is FFP has been very significant in the English Football League. So their rules, again, like the UEFA rules, the break-even concept, but with an allowable loss, much tighter, much closer to that sort of European thing. So just, you know, without throwing too many numbers out there, you could lose £39 million pounds over 3 years, £13 million a year. Now, lots of clubs have failed that, have breached that limit and have lost points. Been a factor in the EFL, been a factor for many clubs, several clubs in on the continent, in Europe, because you need to pass the rules to play in European club competitions, hasn't really been an issue in the Premier League at all.
If you sort of unpick some of that, Dan, from that, not only are rules different depending on competitions, and you could both talk domestically and European wide, different clubs read the rules differently as well.
Without doubt. I mean, especially at the top end of the Premier League, you've got clubs that will be relying on some of the best lawyers around to advise them on what they can do, what they can't do, where are the loopholes in the rules that they could potentially exploit. I think all you have to do is just look at the contracts Chelsea have been handing out, you know, that goes back to the summer with the deals they gave to Fofana and Cucurella, which were long at the time, but no one really talked about it then. But then January comes around and they're handing out kind of 8.5-year deals to Mudryk, and all of a sudden people get talking about that. And that's just Chelsea looking at a loophole and thinking, well, let's exploit that and let's kick these numbers down the road and like amortize all of this money over 8 years rather than five. Now that is all with FFP in mind. You know, UEFA have obviously been quite quick to that because clubs have been moaning about it and they're going to close that loophole. But that just goes to show you that clubs are trying to seek any kind of competitive marginal gain through any kind of loophole that may exist.
Because that appears to be the hot topic at the moment, Chelsea and the long contracts. Dan has spoken, Matt, there about UEFA trying to change that loophole. So that, if UEFA are doing that, that would only affect a club if they qualify for a UEFA competition, wouldn't it?
Correct. Yeah. Well, look, I should probably explain because I think we've skipped a bit. So my first answer, I sort of did the history of FFP. We need to say that UEFA's rules have changed significantly. So they changed last year. So we had 10 years of old FFP, this break-even concept. Now, because of COVID, which put a real strain on the sort of football industry, UEFA, Premier League, they all had to relax their FFP rules, make understandable allowances for the fact that clubs were playing behind closed doors and TV contracts, there were rebates and et cetera, right? So FFP became very confusing for a few years. So you had, right, we've got to look at it again. I think also there was a sense that we have to look at it again because UEFA had lost a couple of really big cases, the Man City case, and that sort of caused the rest of the industry to go, you know, what's the point with these rules? Do you have any teeth or not? And I think also there was probably a third pressure, which was from clubs, challenger type clubs like Man City and PSG and, you know, any or Chelsea under new ownership, saying, well, look, you know, we have money. Why can't we spend it? Why can't we spend our money? We're good for it. You know, we're good for it on making the product better. So they wanted a bit more flexibility on that kind of how much can we lose every year element. UEFA, almost like the quid pro quo, was like, all right, we'll let you lose a bit more money, but we're also going to sort of maintain that concept of sustainability. We're going to sort of double down on that. We want you to be that soft salary cap idea. So they've come up with this new idea, genuinely new, genuinely interesting. And this is why I think it's become a good conversation again. And this is why we get to the Chelsea loophole. They've added this element called the squad cost control rule. The idea here is to limit the amount of money clubs can spend on putting the team on the pitch. So this is about your player wages, what you pay your manager and the coaching staff, your transfer fees, and anything you pay to agents. So really, the money you spend on the team. Okay, we're going to say that you can spend only 70% of your total revenue, everything you bring in, on that, on the products on the pitch. We'll let you take off from the top bit of the equation, if you like, all the bad bits, the wages and the transfer fees. We'll let you take off any profit you make on player sales. So that comes off the numerator. The denominator is that big, taking you back to school here, is the big revenue number. Now, the idea is 70%. But they're also going to say, we're going to give you a few years to get there. So next season, it's 90. The following season, it's 80. It's only 70%. That limit, which I think will be challenging, genuinely challenging. A lot of clubs are breaching it at the moment. For the 2025-2026 season, this year's a free hit, it's 100%. Next year's 90, which I think will be interesting for some clubs, 80, 70. So that's the thing to have in your mind. And that is why every single club, every single big club, I would argue for the first time in a few years, including all the Premier League clubs that have not really worried about it, are right now doing a massive FFP compliance process. And they are inviting consultants in. They're having chats with UEFA. How close are we? Right, okay, we've got to get there in a few years' time. Let's have a look at the rule book. Right, so amortization, we should have a little chat about that. So amortization is just an accounting practice. It's how you write down the cost of buying an asset. So in a football context, your asset, your players. So how do you write that in your accounts? How do you write down paying £30 million for a player? Well, you do it over the course of their contract. Is that weird? No, think about it. At the end of a contract, the asset's worth nothing. Bosman, go away for free, right? So you do it in a straight line basis. Your amortization cost is 10 million a year, 3-year contract. 10, 10, 10 equals 30. But the other half of that is how you put it down as an asset in your books. The asset depreciates, amortizes by 10 every year. So the player is worth 30 million when you buy him, 20 million after year one, 10 million after year two, zero. Again, getting to that, going to zero, amortizing to zero. So that's the idea. Your transfer costs for FFP bases are your amortization costs, your annual amortization cost. Now, to go to Dan's point, the Chelsea trick, if you like, is to buy a £50 million player, or I'm trying to do the sums easier, an £80 million player, and ordinarily give them a 3-year, 4-year contract. Let's say 4-year contract, that's a £20 million charge every year. I'm going to give them an 8-year contract, that's a £10 million charge. You've halved your amortization bill for that player.
Two other things on that then, right? That's a great explanation. Two other things on that. These new rules that are coming in to eventually get to 70% of revenue on what you put on the pitch. You can offset player sales against that, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Any owner investment allowed on that?
Not on the squad cost rule. So at the same time as carrying on with, same time as bringing this new squad cost thing, which I think is genuinely interesting, and I think will be a conversation for the next few years, they're carrying on with that old break-even rule, but they're actually relaxing it. So instead of being able to lose 30 million euros over 3 years, so effectively 10 million euros a year, they're doubling it, saying, guys, you can use 60 million, 20 million euros a season. And here's the nice bit. They're actually saying, if your balance sheet is positive, so, you know, you've got a nice stadium and a training ground and you've got lots of players and you're positive, you know, you're in a net positive position on your balance sheet, we're gonna reward you. You can lose 90 million over 3 years. Now they've basically almost taken the break-even element out of the equation, only for really kind of flagrant basket case type clubs. I can't really see any Premier League clubs failing that. The squad cost control rule is going to be a factor.
Okay, and then the second point goes back to how we started this whole answer if I am, let me pick a deliberately well-run club, so I'm not casting any aspersions. if I'm Brighton, okay?
Yep.
And I go berserk and, you know, spend 90% of revenue for the next decade, every year for the next decade, 90% of revenue on what's going on the pitch. But I never get into the Europa League or the Champions League. So what? Because this is a UEFA rule, not a Premier League rule.
Correct. Come eighth every year. Win the FA Cup. No, well, that gets you to Europe, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, come eighth every year.
Right.
Losing the final.
Yeah. Right. So which highlights the whole issue of different organisations with different rules and when they come into force on your club and when they don't.
Yes, it does.
The other point that Matt made there, Dan, consultants coming in, a whole variety of experts coming into clubs to advise them and help them. I can remember talking to WADA once about drugs in sport and drug testing. And they said because of the money available to teams in a variety of sports, they'll always be one step ahead of WADA because the funding and the science was greater within the areas of people who wanted to cheat than the people trying to stop the cheating. Given the money at a lot of clubs, you would imagine that financial experts and lawyers will do all they possibly can, maybe, to tie the organisations in knots around these rules.
That's always been the thing, right? And I think Matt's kind of written about that extensively in the past, where if a club runs into trouble, they are more than happy to tie these organisations up just in long, drawn-out legal cases because we're happy to pay our lawyers, you know, whatever it costs just to keep you busy, to keep you distracted, keep on kicking this can down the road. Let's go back to Chelsea and that hot topic of what they've done. Well, that loophole's being closed. But to think the clubs aren't already thinking about another way to now exploit these rules, how can we now look at it? To think they're not doing that already would be naive. I mean, I think, you know, as soon as one loophole closes, there's going to be a team of lawyers, legal experts, financial experts looking at what's another way around this? What can we do next? In Matt's piece about Manchester United and their kind of relationship with FFP at the moment, he talks about United bringing in consultants just to kind of get an idea of what can we do, what are we doing, what do we need to be doing. You know, and that's going to be going on across Europe, you'd imagine. Look in Spain, Real Madrid, Barcelona, France with PSG. You'd like to think they're all doing exactly the same, right? It's not just a Premier League thing. You know, it's a UEFA competition. So let's be honest, these clubs have a lot more money and a lot more resources at the top end, and they will be doing everything they can to kind of keep the status quo in order and kick this can down the road, if possible.
Where do the Premier League sit in all of this? Because the Football League have tried to implement theirs, Matt, haven't they, to try and protect a lot of clubs from gambling or going bust. UEFA are doing this basically to try and protect heritage clubs on the one hand, and secondly, to try and limit the power of the Premier League to a certain extent so their competitions don't become League dominated. Where do the Premier League sit and what do the Premier League do?
So I suppose let's go back to that break-even concept. So I explained that, the basic philosophy there. The key difference between the UEFA rule was just the amount you can lose. Just get into the number. So it was 30 million euros, so 10 million euros a year for UEFA. For the Premier League, 35 million pounds. So 105 million pounds over a three-year period. It's always a three-year rolling period. So you can see it's a big difference. Now, the Premier League's point is we don't need to be so prescriptive. We don't need to be so cautious as UEFA because our clubs have this guaranteed broadcast money and we share it more fairly, more evenly than the other leagues do. And we are attracting, a lot of this is sort of, you know, it can sound a bit arrogant, but it's actually kind of borne out by the evidence. We're attracting a different class, different level of wealth. There's our ownership group. They're all good for it. Our clubs will trade, you know, look at the clubs, the players they buy, but equally can sell. And they'll just sort of say, well, look, you know, pre-COVID, I mean, COVID obviously sort of threw everything up into the air a little bit, but pre-COVID, Premier League clubs, they weren't like rolling in it. They weren't like making massive profits, but most of them were just about breaking even. Some of them were making, you know, every now and then they'd make oh, wow, that's a proper profit. I think Liverpool 3-4 years ago made 100 million quid in profit. I think they went something like 30, 130. You know, that's like an incredible sort of 3-year run. And, you know, Man City was starting to make regular profits, small profits, but regular profits. And, you know, everyone struggled in COVID. I suspect we're going to get back to that stage of most clubs making small profits or small losses. So the Premier League can say, look, we're working. If what UEFA are trying to do is to stop bankruptcies and to stop clubs owing the public purse money, we do that. We do that. We have a licensing system. We're very strict about that. Our clubs are paying their taxes and they're paying each other. They're paying their players. We're hot on that. We don't necessarily have to sort of tell people, rich people, how much money they can lose with their money. So that's the difference. It's a difference in philosophy. But I also do think it's a difference in necessity. The Premier League can say, we haven't had a business failure since Portsmouth. We haven't really come close. UEFA, that obviously has to look at the whole of Europe. Yeah, there's red lights on your desk. So that's the difference, I think.
Would you agree, Dan?
It's hard to disagree with anything Matt's just said. And one thing I would kind of point to with the Premier League is, even if you look at the January transfer window, how the Premier League still has so much more financial strength than all the other leagues across Europe. Just look at what they're spending. Look at what's being spent in Spain, Italy, France, and then just compare that to the Premier League. You know, it's chalk and cheese. I think over £400 million has been spent in the Premier League this January.
Yeah, I mean, at the time of recording this, so far in this window, the Premier League spent over £400 million, of which Chelsea have probably spent £398 million. No, I'm only joking.
Over 10 years.
Yeah. The Premier League have spent over £400 million. Bundesliga, £42 million. Serie A, £8 million. And La Liga, £21 million, which, if you want, I'm sure you don't need some context on this, but it means Leeds, for example, have spent more on one player than the combined spend of La Liga and Serie A, which is why UEFA and big European clubs, Dan, are concerned, because Not that Leeds are doing anything wrong, but their product and their leagues get weaker by every transfer window, the more the players arrive in the Premier League.
Well, that's why they all sat around a table and came up with the Super League, right? It was to get away from, you know, it was to create their own kind of guaranteed revenues that the Premier League seemingly has through its broadcast deals. Those numbers you've just read out are startling when you think about it. I mean, that Leeds spending more than, you know, two leagues combined on one player, it's incredible. And again, just goes to show the Premier League is in a different market when it comes to the transfer windows. If there's a player available, in what world would a player have gone to, okay, maybe not Leeds, but trying to think of like a middling Premier League club over one of the better teams in Italy? It just wouldn't have happened kind of 10, 15 years ago. Well, that happens now because the Premier League is the place to be. It's where all the money is. Is that going to stop? I don't think so. You know, but perhaps the broadcast deals are going to stagnate somewhat, especially domestically. I mean, overseas, they are probably still going to grow. But that trend isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The European Super League, this is by no means advocating for it here, Matt. The closed market, here we go with our American sport chat, which is always a... The closed market of the of American sport markets means they control everything, you know, salary. So when we've had salary cap discussions before, we can't have a salary cap in the Premier League if you don't have it in Serie A, because you'll just lose players to Serie A, as is the example.
Yeah.
The European Super League, which we were told would be a closed market, everybody would abide by the same rules.
Well, they wanted it. They wanted quite a strict salary cap. Yeah, they did.
Within that league, I am guessing. That's no means of you know, saying it should happen. But that would be one thing that would happen with it.
Well, it's one thing they talked about. We never really got a chance to see it, did we? Because it all unraveled so quickly. But it was very much part of the sort of DNA, the idea. I mean, Andrea Agnelli, of course, is now former Juve boss. He's got some legal issues to contend with. But it was very much, he was one of the absolute kind of fathers of the Super League. And he talks about this endlessly, how unsustainable the football industry was. You know, he talked about sort of continent-wide issues. And, you know, a lot of it was kind of looking at the Premier League and going, look, we can't keep up. You know, let's group together, us aristocrats, and stop losing money. Like this arms race we're in. Let's have some NFL-style sanity, right, about the amount of money we're spending. And we can all stop losing money. We might even make some money. So that was very much part of the European Super League conversation. And it still comes around. That's why that idea will never really die. And, you know, to pick up on sort of Dan's points about where the Premier League is right now and what the others are thinking about it. COVID hurt them all. They didn't hurt them all equally. Premier League came out of it way better than the others. And it was the only one that during COVID actually managed to up their TV deals, significantly up their TV deals. The domestic deal was the same, but they got a third more, 33% up for their international deals. And it's the only league in any sport anywhere that can say we're getting more money for our international deals than for our domestic deal. That is remarkable. NFL, NBA would, oh my word. You know, they're making loads of money at home, so it's they're okay. But the idea that people in another country are willing to pay more than your own domestic market, I mean, that's just insane. So that's where the Premier League's at. And there are so many different ways we can sort of talk about this. Transfer spend last summer was the same, wasn't it? It was like 89% of the money spent was Premier League money. Deloitte did their Money League list last week. And for the first time, one league provided the majority of the clubs. 11 out of 20 from the Premier League. 16 out of 30. Out of the top 30 from the Premier League. And there was a little note from one of the authors saying, it's almost inevitable that all 20 Premier League clubs will eventually fill the top 30 spots.
Wow.
That's pretty remarkable. That's where the rest of Europe's at right now.
From both your experiences, and Dan, you go first, do you think the Premier League clubs will work together on this issue, or is there too much suspicion of each other? I mean, look, fans very much think that maybe their club is doing things properly and rivals aren't. I mean, that's how fans work. Is there too much suspicion amongst Premier League clubs about how things are being done at each other's financial levels, or will they work together? Do they work together?
Well, you'd like to think they'd all sit around and work together on this, but then it kind of, in your question, you hinted they're all at different levels, right? Financial restrictions on Manchester United are going to be completely different for a club like Southampton, for example. They're going to want two different kinds of things, you'd imagine. They're not all going to want to be the same thing. United are thinking about Europe and Southampton are thinking about purely domestic level. So they're going to want more evenness in the Premier League, whereas United have got to think about, well, we want to win European titles, so we need a bit more kind of money to spend. I think, you know, those discussions around the Super League, you know, that stung, and I think that broke a lot of relationships. And yeah, I know a lot of those people have changed now, and there's different people sat around the table from some of those clubs at these Premier League meetings. So I imagine the bridges are being rebuilt, and if they're going to want to kind of protect the Premier League and its interests, they are going to have to form a consensus, right? you need at least 14 clubs to vote anything through. And it would make sense for those top six, the Super League sides, to engage in that, because you don't want, you know, the Premier League loves to have like unanimity, right? It wants votes to sail through. It doesn't want one or two voting against. It wants unanimity across the board. So they're going to have to work together, whether they like it or not. And, you know, there's already been talk and, you know, extensive reports about new kind of possible tweaks to the Premier League's financial rules, and how they end up looking, you know, remains to be seen. But it's certainly going to be an interesting topic that will continue to kind of rumble on over the coming months.
Does the recent arrival of wealth funds, investment funds, hedge funds, not only in football clubs, but actually in owning competitions and investing in competitions, we've seen it in other sports, it could very well come in football, it might already have in some areas. Does that complicate matters further, Matt? Do they, because they presumably want slightly different things out of what they invest in than, say, the local businessman who puts money into a club he loves?
It certainly complicates things from a kind of general governance point of view. And I think one of the big stories, and we've done a few pods and pieces on it in the past, haven't we, about this kind of idea of multi-club ownership models, which is one of the big ideas, right? So basically just conglomerates. And a lot of US money loves this idea because they've been doing bits of it at home, where you have an NFL team, an NBA team, blah, 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 an MLS team, and you'll have a network, a sports network, and you'll own the stadiums. So, you know, you create a little kind of, you know, mini conglomerate. I mean, they're not mini, some of them are huge. So FSG, of course, you know, have a baseball team and an ice hockey team, and the Cronkies have everything. So, you know, we're seeing that already. Now, when you mentioned like the funds, the arrival of let's just do two versions of them. The kind of North American institutional money, it doesn't have to be North American, but kind of institutional money, they're buying small strategic stakes. Now, I think that does pose issues because, well, there's conflicts of interest. Who's really in charge here? It makes things murky. And I think we're getting to some of these debates right now. And, you know, UEFA has this rule that if you own two clubs, if you control two clubs, they can't both play in the same competition. It's a really straightforward, obvious rule. I think most people can get their head around the issues there. Red Bull was the famous test case with Leipzig and Salzburg. They kind of fudged it and got around it somehow. But it took, you know, it was a row. We're getting close to that being quite a common row, to be honest. So that's the issue there. And of course, the other type of fund is sovereign wealth funds, right? Nation states. That has brought a whole different level of complexity to the whole market, and how, from an FF point, to sort of tie it back to FFP, how, with PSG and Man City being the two obvious cases, and I think Newcastle going forward, but those two have been like this sort of long-running row, how do you treat their sponsors from Qatar and UAE, right? Are they genuinely benchmarked commercial deals in the same way that Man United chat to Chevrolet or TeamViewer or whatever it is? Is a company saying, hello, we like the look of you, we think putting our name on your shirt is going to reach this many people, and we're willing to pay this much because that's the going rate? Or is it one branch of a government saying to another branch of the government, we need this number to meet our FFP number, that's how much you have to, you know, I've simplified it, but that's the Man City story, right? And it's an endless debate. So that's the complexity there. And yes, it has made things really, really hard.
What are the deterrents? Are they strong enough? Because finally on this, I would suggest that fans will just shrug to a certain extent, because they know that even if rules are broken and clubs do wrong, that the punishments are minimal. And people might look at the big clubs here, but we've seen evidence of teams getting promoted from the Championship having broken various financial rules there, and they'll get a small fine for doing it, because that actually, and when I say small, it's relative, because they've got 100 million for getting promoted, so they don't lose the promotion. Fans feel that punishments may not be enough, I think. And clubs will always find a way around it.
Yes, is a short answer to all of that. And I completely understand. So just on your EFL Premier League example, that's a classic case of sort of different jurisdictions. So clubs that get promoted that would have breached EFL rules if they hadn't got promoted, and it sometimes come down to the playoff final, right? So a real sliding door moment. They're not punished at all. But as they go on to Premier League rules, and the Premier League, the loss was allowable. And then fine, you're right, the Premier League money starts to flow. Nearly all of them make money, and nearly all of them make a profit in their first year in the Premier League. Problem over. So there's a classic case of, oh my word, just a jurisdiction issue. Now, just to remind, this is the sort of story that just, as you say, goes over fans' heads. Even under those old UEFA rules, which I sort of suggested weren't that weren't that significant, some clubs got punished last year. Some quite big clubs: PSG, Marseille, Monaco, Juve, AC, Inter. They failed. They failed the break-even rule, and they got fined. But they only have to pay 15% of it. So there you go. So so PSG got fined 60 million euros. They've only got to pay 10 million euros. Because well, we've signed an agreement. We had a chat about it. So here's your fine. The rest is all suspended for good behaviour, blah, 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 blah. So PSG, for about the second, third time, I lose track sometimes, breached that rule. And it's not even a fine. This is the thing, it's not even a fine. It's deducted from the money that UEFA give them. So talk about that. That then just becomes a cost of doing business, doesn't it? It becomes the cost of doing, it's a luxury tax. PSG will go, yeah, we breached it. We've got the highest wage bill in Europe. My word. I mean, this is, so I'm racing ahead to my point here. And that is, everyone is worried and alarmed about the Premier League's financial muscle. It's obvious. You look at the numbers, you're like, oh my word, this is worrying. But at the moment, it hasn't really translated into an era of domination on the pitch, because Real have carried on being Real. PSG have carried on being PSG. Bayern haven't gone away. The Premier League's clubs look really healthy, and you're right, the 15th best team in the Premier League can now outbid the third or second best team in whatever, right? But it's not translated into that true era of domination where you really, or everyone goes, oh wow, we've totally lost the competitive balance here. Will it? I don't know. Maybe. It hasn't happened yet.
It's a model, isn't it? I mean, it is. The whole situation is a model, as we've kind of illustrated throughout the podcast. Do you see any way that it stops being a model, Dan?
With UEFA's new rules, it's going to take until 2025, as Matt's already explained, for those to kind of kick in properly. So then you're looking, well, maybe once that's kicked in, then do you wait another couple of years to see how it all plays out? So then you're thinking, well, 5 years down the line, we might have an idea of what these rules are going to mean, and you know whether the Premier League will have new rules by then too. But again, you'd imagine they'd wean anything in, because it'd be too sudden just to go, bang, here's your new rules, now you'll have to abide by them. So no, I think it's going to stay muddled for quite some time.
To be fair to UEFA, right, with these new rules that they announced last year, they actually announced a sort of table of potential punishments, and it's graduated, right? So if you fail a little bit, you're probably looking at a fine. If you fail a bit more, we're going to start talking about sporting sanctions, right? So suddenly people's ears prick up. Right, oh, hold on. Fans, you should be listening now. Sporting sanctions. And actually the move of the Champions League to that league table, which again we've talked about, that Swiss model, does actually play into this quite nicely. So if Club X blows the 70% by a mile, 80%, 85% over, and maybe loses 6 points, 9 points, I don't know. We'll see how they start to sort of, you know, dish the penalties out, or has there some sort of limit on the size of their squad, or, you know, that sort of thing, kind of a combination of measures. Yeah, maybe behaviour will change. If you are not progressing in the Champions League because you've been docked points, that might happen. And then, of course, the sort of nuclear option, well, we'll ban you. You know, if you're blowing it by bloody miles and you're not listening to us and you keep doing it, you can't play in the Champions League. And every single big club in Europe, wherever you are, cares about that.
Matt, Dan, thank you very much. Plenty more from the pair of them on this subject on The Athletic now. Plus all the latest transfer lines from the likes of David Ornstein. If you're not already a subscriber, you can take advantage of this offer at the moment, £1.99 a month for the first 12 months. Just go to theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.